It might have been blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I have as my special featured guest this first hour, Alan J. Salarian, a psychiatrist who is the top chief shrink for the FBI. He has published a new book entitled JFK, The Magnificent Journey. Before I bring in Alan and we look at his book, however, here's a short video clip to take you back to not the 22nd, but the 24th of November, 1963. Which was, again, another tragic and fateful day. Stand by. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, again, where I'm very glad to welcome Alan Salarian back to the show. Alan, it's a great pleasure to have you here again.
Thank you, Jim. I'm honored by the invitation and the opportunity.
Because we had some technical delays, we may move more rapidly than had been planned. Here's the image of the cover of your book, Alan, JFK, The Magnificent Journey. And on the back, there's a detailed description about you, including the observation that this a modest and unpretentious book, but it packs a punch. By the time you've made your way to the end, you understand what happened to JFK and why he was taken out. All in all, a remarkable achievement. This book provides perceptions and insights that will benefit us all, from the novice to the expert on the death of JFK. And I say that especially, Alan, because as a psychiatrist, you've been in the position to make observations unique to your profession, unlike those of any other commentator on the death of JFK.
Yes, it's so true. And this book really combines my psychiatric background and forensic background and observations. But I say that the book is very consumer friendly because it's very visual. Photographs and images often tell the story, not only what's happening, but what's being avoided. There are a lot of photographs that are included in the book, whereby just studying them, we see how people avoid certain things, and the avoidance itself is psychologically significant.
For instance, yes, I agree completely.
The photo of Captain Fritz, looking or walking the other way when Oswald was being shot. I mean, that's a picture that tells a lot because, after all, Oswald was under his custody. We have another picture that's very telling about Secret Service agents, for instance, washing off the limo after the assassination at Parkland Hospital's parking lot. And how come a document like that, a picture like this, was omitted, was avoided intentionally or unintentionally by the Warren Commission? So what has been omitted, what has been avoided, has psychological significance as well.
Yes, Alan, we want to begin with the contents of your book, which I have here in three slides, with a foreword, a preface, an introduction, a letter to Callie. Chapter one, Chief Justice Warren versus Mother Oswald. Chapter two, The Nature of Complexity. Chapter three, Who Was Lee Oswald? Chapter four, Victim of a Complex Crime. Chapter five, What About the Warren Report? Chapter 6, The Journey of Private Dinkins. Next slide. 7, Oswald Working for the U.S. Government. Chapter 8, Why Did Fritz Look Away When Ruby Killed Oswald? Chapter 9, The Impossible Job of Chief Justice Warren. Chapter 10, Premature Deaths of Witnesses and Reporters. Chapter 11, Are We Observing Cerebrogenocide? Chapter 12, Oswald Did Not Kill JFK. Chapter 13, The Sad News About Greer, Kellerman, and Roberts. Chapter 14, What the Secret Service Has to Tell Us. Chapter 15, The Sad Truth About the Zapruder Film. Chapter 16, The Sad News About Alchins. Chapter 17, Photopsychology, The Crucial Moment. Chapter 18, Understanding Photographic Reconstruction. Chapter 19, Complexity and the Death of JFK. Chapter 20, Treason from the Inside. Chapter 21, Why Did JFK Die? Postscript for Kelly, Bibliography About the Author and Index, Alan. And let's begin with your letter to Kelly. Tell us what this letter represents. I can read it if you like, or you may if you are so disposed.
And why don't you read it, Jim? I think you're better at that.
Dear Kelly, you are very dear to me. Your youthful bluntness to say what you observe is extraordinarily refreshing. One day, sometime after I am gone, you could be our president. I believe you have all the essential gifts to become a president, including the desire to lead. Please hold on to your values after you enter the White House. Please protect your soul and do not let your triumphs compromise you. JFK was a great man who defended reason and prevented a nuclear war. He has been my hero ever since. I want you to watch 6 images and reach your own conclusion about JFK's death. Then write down on a piece of paper a note to yourself and say, I will not change when I become president. Sign it and remember your pledge.
Yeah, Kaylee is a real character. She is a 16-year-old Virginian, a high school student that I had the privilege to know for some time. She's the daughter of a very dear friend. And I've always been struck by her honesty and bluntness about realities and her very basic questions about JFK. That's why I dedicated this to her. And in some ways, I thought if I could make Kaylee understand what happened to JFK in very simple words and pictures, I would be able to be as effective with the rest of the world. And that's a symbolism about Kaylee. That's the letter.
Each of your chapters has one of your paintings, which I find quite striking and remarkable, followed by a poem. That, of course, is the book depository in the background with a motorcade headed down Elm Street. With a poem, this is your first in the book, I Dream Thinking, in memory of JFK. Dreaming often, I dream thinking, remembering JFK of simple things, simple wishes of life. Should I be dreaming pink, red, orange, vibrant colors, traveling to stars, impossible things, inconceivable perhaps, unnatural by nature, never occurred on earth, never before, never once. Should I be dream free? Should I let my dreams flee? My government, civil servants, my president being honest, zero tolerance for lies about big things, war and peace, simple things. I shall dream zero big lies. I shall dream. And indeed, Alan, I regard this as the theme of your work, namely to represent the truth about the assassination, where here we have a particularly good version of the Alchins 6, which gives us a sense of what you were representing when you painted about the book depository. And now here's that series of images you want Kaylee to consider. Here, first, Kellerman. Why did Kellerman wash off the crime scene evidence? And indeed, we have a photograph where you can see the bucket and a Secret Service agent took a sponge and a bucket of water and began to wash the blood off the back of the seat. In the next slide, you see a report that appeared in the Christchurch Star, Kennedy shot dead, seemingly before he'd even been officially pronounced dead. And there you see Jackie with her huge bouquet of red roses, Everywhere else in Texas, she'd received yellow roses. But in this instance, the red roses were to remind the shooters she was not to be hit and the location of her husband right beside. The next is the National Security Agency document that was prepared before JFK was dead, just as a new national security directive for the new president to withdraw our forces from Vietnam was also prepared before his death. Here's yet another about the Zapruder. We have three women who have five legs. Alan, that's an astute observation. The women labeled 9, 10, and 11. Here's another from the Zapruder film. Here we have three legs from one person in the background and two alterations, which obviously raises serious questions about the alteration of the film, of which there are many others. But you, I think, have put your finger on some that others have not noticed, Alan.
Yes, and what's interesting, the simplicity, the directness of the cheating, the reengineering, and make it very clear that this is a dishonest job. This is reengineering. You don't have to explain it. Here is the photo that tells you the truth of the cover-up and how it was accomplished. And while we're on Alkins, because in this picture we see Alkins, it's important to notice that Alkins is right there with his camera, and he had 10 seconds to take pictures of the assassination, the best pictures. And for those 10 seconds, he did not take any. And that's the psychological significance of avoidance. How on earth somebody, a veteran photographer like Alkins, would not be taking pictures when the president's limousine has stopped and he is being ambushed? Psychologically significant, I find it, as part of the overall complicity.
I thought we'd look at three or four sample chapters, Alan, beginning with chapter 7, which is preceded by a drawing, a painting of JFK, another poem, Making Waves for Truth. I have been praying hard, praying and pleading, bleeding, praying and bleeding, praying and yelling, yelling for truth. Exhaling shrieks, shrieks across the Atlantic, my plight, my voice, lonesome voice in space, making waves in ocean and land, forming clouds, giant clouds, watering my throat for louder voices, making new waves for truth, which I think is a very apt description of your book, my friend. And here is the introduction to chapter 7. Oswald working for the U.S. government. There is no single smoking gun to prove clearly and directly that Oswald worked for the U.S. government, yet the cumulative evidence strongly points in the direction of his having been a rather good spy. Oswald's profile is a good match for an American James Bond. I would consider it very unlikely for a young and supposedly troubled young man from New Orleans, Louisiana, to be fluent in Russian and Spanish. And when and how did he learn to speak Russian so well that when he first met Marina, his future wife, who was Russian, she thought that he was Russian too? Oswald's fluency in Russian was a credit to his language training. Let us also remember that this was a time of extreme tension between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. So how could Oswald manage to get in and out of the Soviet Union so easily and so fast? How could Oswald obtain a passport with travel expenses paid by the U.S. Department of State after having renounced his American citizenship? The paper trail of Oswald's covert functions for the U.S. government can be supported by two independent documents. One is a medical certificate confirming that he had contracted gonorrhea while he was stationed in Japan, but that it was in the performance of his duties. And as you continue with the next slide, in plain English, this meant he was a spy who was having sex to gain information. Oswald worked as a radar operator at the Tsugi Air Base in Japan, the home of U-2 top secret flights across the Soviet Union. This means he must have had a high security clearance. Here you have a nice summary of evidence indicating that this man was indeed working for the government. where I agree completely in your conclusion, Alan. I think you've hit the nail right on the head.
And that's why I think, Jim, his mother said that, Oswald's mother said on the day of his burial that he should be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, and I agree with that.
Well, I agree with that, too. Let's take a look at another chapter, Alan. Here's the drawing, one of your most striking, that precedes this chapter of Jackie Kennedy. I find this a very disturbing painting. Then a poem, Who is the King? Who is the King? Who is in charge in universe on Earth, Moon, Saturn, Jupiter, or Pluto? Who is my Lord? Who is the mother of all kings? Chinese, Ethiopian, ancient Mesopotamians, traveling through Bosphorus to Venice, wood carving merchants, gunpowder mercenaries, truck drivers, foot soldiers. Luckily, I met the king during one of my trials in Abingdon, Virginia, trials of life through history, and asked, what makes you my king? What's your power, your precise properties of infinite supremacy? The king smiled, gently patting my brain. Come close to me, he whispered. No, much closer, my boy, much closer. Sit on my lap, my baby boy. Don't be afraid. Let your body free. Let your soul rest before I tell you I am your king ever since I met your mother, nature. And here's a photograph that we...
I want to say something about the poem.
That yes.
Is, when I say nature, what I mean is the truth.
That yes.
The truth is the reality for us. And
yes.
This book is in search of the truth.
And the reason I wanted to play that clip before we reach this point is that chapter 8 is devoted to the question, why did Fritz look away when Ruby shot Oswald? Here you see Ruby stepping forward, but Fritz has already passed by. And if we look at the first page of the chapter 8, slide 22, we see, you know, your marvelous analysis, Alan. I don't want to read it. I want you to just tell us about it as you were to begin with in the beginning after we looked at the video clip.
In human reactions and in mammalian reactions, reflexes matter, that there are a lot of things that happen naturally. So when somebody is in pain, when somebody is being shot, the natural response is to gravitate toward the crisis, toward the pain. And it's very unnatural, absolutely artificial, for somebody to not look at a crime as it's occurring and walking away. That's the obvious psychological significance of Captain Fritz in that particular photo, when as Oswald is getting killed by Ruby, being shot in the stomach, Fritz is walking away. I think it's the photo included in the book, I don't know what page, that shows clearly it's a marvelous capsulation of unnatural and criminal acts.
Let's go to the next slide, yes. Will you further elaborate on the abnormality of his not looking at what took place? Other signs of Fritz's complicity? He made a few more blunders with plenty of paper trail evidence of criminal negligence. The wrongful identification of the alleged murder weapon is one of them. The obvious problem is not simply that after the initial declaration of the weapon as a Mauser, it inexplicably becomes a Maker Carcano, but rather that Captain Fritz never bothered to offer an explanation for the change. The subject of Captain Fritz not having tape recorded his lengthy interrogations of Oswald has received plenty of attention. This is criminal negligence. So in essence, the photographs express an inner voice, the invisible voice of Captain Fritz. They tell us that he was an active participant in the cover-up. I have no doubt about it, Alan. You're completely right. Would you like to add?
No, I think it's well said enough about Fritz.
Okay.
Stop.
Then when we turn to chapter 10, we have another image of John saluting, a variation on which you use as the cover of your book. And here is another of your poems. And one of the features I love the most about your book, Alan, is this mix of paintings with poetry, with analysis of the evidence. Salutation. The inferno in me, neither red nor black. The kindling, not fading nor raging. Speechless I stand by battles lost, battles long. People loved, friends gone. No farewell, no tears, ashes warm. Trumpets will mourn, friends gone, damaged limbs, trees, branches, giant roots. Is war over? Limbs under bridge, does it matter who won? My inferno will be gone when I am gone. Today I stand up alone, saluting my friends, ashes warm, rekindling memories. And with that,
we say something about this salutation. This salutation is to all the courageous writers and researchers who risked their lives and lost their lives to find the truth about JFK. I salute them. And that's an interesting thing that I shared with you before, that I perhaps had some poetic inclinations and painting abilities, but I never practiced them. They were all in my heart. They were all in my brain. Until I got into JFK research, and the atrocities, the depth of carnage, the depth of deception and betrayal, and the deception against democracy and humanity really made me sick. And whatever pain that I endured then turned into poetry and paintings. That's why you see them in this book.
Yes, I think you've drawn something very positive from anguish and pain. Here you have a short but an incomplete list of witnesses, reporters, investigators who died suddenly or prematurely or under suspicious circumstances. This page has a dozen. Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr., Dorothy Kilgallen, C.D. Jackson, Paul Mandel, Hank Sudum, Lou Staples, Bill Hunter, James Cothey, James Alchins, and then the list continues. Gary Underhill, William Colby, William Sullivan, Louis Nichols, James Cadogan, J.M. English, General Earl Wheeler, Roger Craig, Hiram Ingram, James Cheney, Bill Decker, Frank Martin, E.R. Walters, Dr. Nicholas Chatta, Dr. James Weston, Dr. Mary Sherman, William Pritzer, Congressman Hale Boggs, Thomas Howard, Earl Smith, Henry DeLoon, Dr. John Holbrook, Clayton Fowler. And in addition, you have a marvelous diagram here, why Kennedy died, the evidence, Alan, I'd like you very much to expand upon.
Yeah, I think that the basic issues involved in this very politically motivated assassination was Kennedy's plans to incorporate CIA under the army, under the Joint Chiefs. And also his very firm stand on Vietnam, saying that we're not going to engage the U.S. military in Vietnam. And in fact, giving the orders in October 1963 by writing NSAM 263 and ordering the withdrawal of the U.S. military starting by December 1963. I think these were the crucial events. I think as a president, he was very courageous, he was honest, and he was able to draw the line against irrational wars. And he paid the price with his life.
And here is the concluding page of the your chapter on the witnesses, which represents data gathered from public records and JFK-related research. Early deaths, number of deaths, law enforcement 13, reporters 7, doctors 4, attorneys 3, armed forces 2, congressman 1, Jack Ruby associate and premature deaths, attorneys 2, reporters 3, psychiatrist 1, self 1. Well done. And here is the next chapter we are going to review. Are we observing cerebrogenocide, a term that you introduced, Alan? And here you have another of your fascinating paintings and a new poem, An Ass and a Fox. On an empty bus going nowhere, idling engine, a bus passes by, then a lion and two donkeys, arguing about hard labor, not enough food, bad bosses, inflation, rude young asses, dogs barking too much. Hey, driver, can we go already? Yes, sir, the driver says. You're the boss. Tell me where to go. I'd love to see the White House or Lincoln Memorial. Give me a bigger challenge, the driver says. Take me to heaven, I say, the real one or the one man-made. You decide. The real one is easy. All I have to do is kill you. The one here, perhaps difficult. You need a passport and you have none. For you're an ass and this is a fox jungle. Alan?
Yeah, I think it applies a lot to the realities of JFK's life and his death. That it's almost a battle about democracy and freedom. You're either on this side or you're on that side. If you're on the wrong side, you end up in hell.
And here's the start of your chapter 11 about, are we observing cerebrogenocide? Why don't you talk about that concept, Alan, which you elaborate here?
This concept goes back to the Armenian genocide and to the Jewish Holocaust, where it was observed that before the genocide of large masses, the intellectuals of the ethnic communities were targeted and eliminated. This was particularly very striking in the Armenian genocide of 1915, where some 250 Armenian intellectuals, doctors, pharmacists, congressmen, writers, and comedians were selected to be executed. And what it did, It silenced the population because they were the leaders. They were the voices for the population. I saw a similar pattern in the Jewish Holocaust during the Nazi era, and certainly Stalin did something similar. How it applies to us, to America, is, yes, we did not have a genocide, but I can say we really murdered democracy. In the process of this, to force military forces upon democracy and freedom, we specifically targeted intelligentsia and the leaders, the voices who pointed out the criminal elements in our government, and they were eliminated. And this is, that way, justifies in some ways the term cerebrogenocide. I believe the death of reporters and the death of many civil servants in the assassination and the cover-up of JFK qualify as cerebrogenocide.
Here's the next page of that chapter where you go into this in greater detail. As the organized killing of the intelligentsia, those who are taking an active interest in investigating a crime in this case, where your list, as you observe, is conservative, because there were also many other innocent witnesses. William Whaley, the cab driver who gave Oswald his final taxi ride. Lee Bowers, the man in the railroad tower behind the Dealey Plaza. Rose Sheremy and Carrick Kapinsett, both of whom predicted JFK's death before November 22nd and also meant premature deaths. And on the next page, you talk about Slide 34, Kent. Yes. Perhaps some small-time criminals with mafia ties had something to do with these unfortunate killings, but they cannot explain the catastrophic demise of the American intelligentsia. JFK Jr., Dorothy Kilgallen, and Lou Staples were victimized soon after making public statements of intent to further investigate or publish about the assassination. All six Dallas policemen who perished had made public statements contradictory to the misrepresentations by the Dallas Police Department. The evidence is also consistent that Ruby Oswald associates were eliminated. Howard and Fuller, both attorneys for Jack Ruby, the Ruby forensic psychiatrist, all three reporters with access to Ruby died of unnatural, premature reasons. William Sullivan, the FBI's number two man, killed in a bizarre hunting accident prior to his scheduled testimony before the Senate committee. He was, as an aside, purportedly mistaken for a deer. Gary Underhill, a CIA agent, even predicted his own death by gunshot wounds to the head. In essence, there's an apparent mathematical certainty of the conclusion that many intellectuals with crucial information about JFK's death were silenced. And that may be the sad but correct answer to how could such serious criminal actions have remained secrets for more than 50 years. Turning to another chapter, Alan, here's one of my favorite of all of your paintings, JFK and John John in a boat. The poem that precedes chapter 13, the sad news about Greer, Kellerman, and Roberts, reads as follows. Like an apple in an orchard. Where life begins, where it ends, you are confused, my friend, confused like an apple in an orchard, living or a non-living thing. Do forests feel? Do tanks sense? Do bullets sob? Is virus a living? Why not my memory? Who is kind? Who is coward? Who is reckless or daring? An apple, once living, may fall prey to masters, maestros of lies and liars. Aren't we all like apples? Empathy for an apple may come from a sudden fall, sudden and earth-shaking. You may not mind being eaten, eaten alive, even thanking the mouth, thanking a lot your new host, your new home. Alan.
A poem actually is an integration of some of the horrors that I experienced in my own life, and also in sympathy with a lot of writers and researchers who suffered tremendously because of their research of JFK assassination.
Alan, in this next chapter 13, the sad news, you point out 10 mistakes by three Secret Service men. I'll just point out the mistakes ever so briefly. One, topless car, hostile environment, responsible agent, Emery Roberts. On the next page, we have mistake number two, leaving two agents behind, responsible agent, Emery Roberts. Mistake number three, unsafe travel route with two 90-degree turns, responsible agent, Forrest Sorrells. Mistake number four, refusal to receive assistance from the U.S. Army 112th Military Intelligence Group, agent unknown. Mistake number five, failure to clear rooftop bridges and high-risk spots, responsible agent Forrest Sorrells. Mistake number six, no response to hostile threats, responsible agent Roy Kellerman. And here on the next page, we see one of those motorcade routes, which after coming down Main Street and taking the right to Houston, there was a 110-degree turn onto Elm Street, which was a violation of Secret Service protocol. On the next page, we see no response to hostile threats. Mistake number seven, no attempt to protect the president during gunfire. Responsible agent Roy Kellerman. Mistake number eight, no attempt to fire back. Responsible agent Roy Kellerman. I think Emery Roberts was a part of that too, Alan. He actually called back John Reddy, who started to move forward. The next page, mistake number nine, deceleration during gunfire, responsible agent William Greer. Actually, during the show, the hour following this, we will talk about the fact that the limousine was actually brought to a halt and we'll discuss alternative reports about how long the stop endured. But there's no doubt about the stop, as those who stand by will discover. Mistake number 10, washing off the crime scene evidence, responsible agent Roy Kellerman. And here we see a photograph of the Secret Service agent, where, by the way, Alan, a friend of the driver, Sam Kinney, of the Secret Service Cadillac, contacted me 10 years after Sam Kinney's death to tell me that Sam had told him that he was the Secret Service agent who took the bucket of water and the sponge to wash the blood and brains off of the seat. So it may, in fact, be Sam Kinney who was the responsible agent here rather than Roy Kellerman.
Jim, I will be very doubtful of that because of the height. I think Sam Kinney was not as tall as Roy Kellerman.
Oh, you see, that man right there. They're putting that on the cover. They're covering the limo right there. So you think the tall man is indeed Roy Kellerman.
Yes.
Very interesting.
He might have participated, and there may be other pictures that we don't know, but in this picture, I point the finger at Roy Kellerman.
He was because I know it's so important to your account. I want to turn to chapter 20, treason from the inside, where you have a report here, and this is a drawing of Madeline Duncan Brown, with whom I had over 100 conversations. Alan, I interviewed her at the JFK Lancer conference in Dallas, which can still be obtained from JFK Lancer Productions. And went through her story. I got to know her well, and she reported several indications that Lyndon knew in advance of the assassination, where she became convinced that he had been profoundly involved. The next page, the next slide, reviews some of the indications of conspiracy over and beyond Madeline's testimony, including the NSO memo of 11/21/1963 announcing the president's death one day before it occurred, the Christchurch Star News announcing the president's death and Oswald's guilt before the president died, the reengineering of the Zapruder movie and of James Alchin's AP photographs of the ambush at Dealey Plaza, invalid postmortem examination and altered x-rays of the president at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where, and this is among the most important points you make, Alan, JFK's top aides, Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, and McGeorge Bundy, his national security advisor, did not speak to one another after 1996, when McNamara's In Retrospect became a national bestseller. And in the next page, you talk about why McNamara blamed Bundy directly, quietly displaying the obvious treason by Bundy aides to undermine the president's policy of disengagement in Vietnam. He documents treacheries by Hillsman and Forrestal to authorize a coup d'etat in Vietnam and the assassination of the Diem brothers in violation of JFK's order. This is really fascinating stuff, Alan. And indeed, in documenting McGeorge Bundy's role, you include his contributions to the reversal of JFK's order of air support for rebels at the Bay of Pigs, the cable of August 27, 1963 to Ambassador Lodge green-lighting a coup in Vietnam, the personal note from his assistant Hillman to Lodge authorizing the coup, keeping General Harkins in the dark about the coup in Vietnam. And on the next page, destroying the November 1963 White House tapes under his custody, misleading and misrepresenting his National Security Action Memorandum 273 by adding an addendum on 11/21/1963, the day before JFK's murder, with an ominous warning of a threat to national security, that urged everyone to unite and defend the United States government, both here and in the field. And on the next page, Alan, you include the National Security Action Memorandum, November number 273. President has reviewed discussions of South Vietnam, which occurred in Honolulu, and has discussed the matter further with Ambassador Lodge, He directs that the following guidance be issued to all concerned. It is of the highest importance that the United States government avoid either the appearance or the reality of public recrimination from one part of it against another. And the president expects that all senior officers of the government will take energetic steps to ensure that they have their subordinates go out of their way to maintain and to defend the unity of the United States government, both here and in the field. The president did not speak with Ambassador Lodge because the president was in Texas and Ambassador Lodge was in Honolulu, and the president had no reason to order all senior government officials to unite and defend the government the day before he died. This memorandum, of course, was one that would be signed by the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, Allen.
Yeah, I think this is a very important, crucial document that proves that Bundy was the chief engineer of JFK assassination. That the day before, he was misrepresenting what had taken place and misrepresenting an imaginary meeting between President Kennedy and Ambassador Lodge, and also including a paragraph as if in anticipation of a national crisis, which was the death of the president, but was not known on 11/21.
Yes, absolutely. I think your points are impeccable.
The single most important document to indict Bundy of President Kennedy's death.
And here's our last slide for the evening, Alan, which is, again, the cover of your book, which I highly recommend. It's available on Amazon.com. Is it also out in a Kindle edition now, Alan?
It will be soon. I don't believe it is, but it will be in Kindle soon.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I can't thank you enough for being here this evening with me, Alan. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, thanking Dr. Alan J. Solarian, the former top shrink for the FBI, and congratulating him on the production of his new book, JFK, The Magnificent Journey, which is available now on Amazon.com. Stand by for the second hour, the new JFK show with Gary King.
Hi, I'm Josh Steffler from Freedom Free for All Television. And with the media going completely corporately controlled in this day and age, we couldn't put shows on like this without the help of our independent media partners, MBC, Media Broadcasting Center. So if you like this show, check them out on WeBookYourShow.com, and you can find all sorts of different channels promoting liberty, freedom, and an independent press and an independent media. Thank you for watching.
We can now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people. people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy. And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK Show number 74. We've got Don Fox, who will be joining us later. We've got the man, Dr. James Fetzer. We've got Larry Rivera and myself, and we've got Chance George in the engineer's chair once again. All right, so we have a problem again there, Dr. Fetzer, and we're going to get to that first. However, the last two shows have been with Robert Morningstar, and I thought they were incredible shows. However, you are a 100%er, so you have a little bit of correction. So let's go ahead and talk about that first, and then we'll get into the problem that we have in the JFK community and how we're going to deal with it.
Thanks, Gary. Sure. I just wanted to make a few fine tunes to some of Robert's remarks that are of a more technical character. We know from Doug Horn's research, which is published in Volume 4, of his magisterial Inside the ARRB of 2009, that the original of the Zapruder film was taken to the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. It was an 8mm already split film that had been developed in Dallas. They had no 8mm projector and had to ask a store owner to open his shop so they could buy one to even view it. They prepared a briefing board, briefing boards based upon the original film. But Sunday, when a different crew was working, the substitute film was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center for the switch to be made. It was a 16mm unsplit film that had been developed in Rochester. When Robert talked about the briefing board, the number of frames he referred to in the counts for the second briefing board, where the first apparently no longer exists, were counts of frames in between what were taken to be the frames that showed the shots. They were not a report of missing frames. The frames that were missing had already been deleted in Rochester, where the CIA had revised the film at a secret lab adjacent to Kodak headquarters known as Hawkeye Works. So I just wanted to clarify some of these points. They were able to recover the second set of briefing boards, and I even reported about it. I had two short reports from Doug Horn ready in Murder in Dealey Plaza, published in the year 2000. So I thought it was great to have Robert on, but that it would be important to correct a few of these technical details.
Mm-hmm. You want to comment on that, Larry?
No, I agree with Jim 100%. I was a little surprised when he mentioned, you know, so many frames that had been deleted, and that sort of did not correspond with what we know about the Zapruder film. So, that's a pretty good wrap up on that.
Mm-hmm. So your overall impression of our two shows with Morningstar, Dr. Fetzer?
Oh, I thought they were very interesting. Morningstar has kind of been a loner. He was more or less isolated within the research community by Robert Morningstar already as early as 1993, which bothered me tremendously because Morningstar was at that point talking about these condensation trails he'd identified in the frames, where Robert Morningstar was seeking to dismiss them with no evidence whatsoever. And it was the occasion when I made my first public statement to a group of JFK students by having to stand up and explain that what Grodin was doing was completely inappropriate, that what Morningstar was offering was a scientific analysis, that in order to rebut it, you needed additional scientific analysis, not bland dismissal such as Robert Grodin was presenting then. So I was at odds with Grodin from the very beginning, but I think it was most unfortunate, maybe to be expected, that my very first public statement would be one of, you know, criticism of a man who many regarded at that point in time as the leading student of the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, as Larry once said, he was larger than life at one time. No comment, Larry?
No, absolutely, I'm good.
All right. I was quite surprised to hear that Grodin was charging $5,000 and Morningstar felt it as a civic duty to go ahead and play it for free. So,
yeah, well, that's good. Of course, he would eventually get it onto the Geraldo show in 1975 with Dick Gregory, which excited a tremendous amount of interest. In fact, it was that showing on the Geraldo show that led to the formation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations and their re-review of the assassination of JFK and of Martin Luther King, which involved, you know, re-genetical evidence the way I think many of them felt it should have been done from the beginning. But was clearly grotesque in its character because you had the fist-sized wound from Parkland. You had that expanded into the size of a footprint at Bethesda, as David Lifton so astutely understood and explained already in Best Evidence in 1980. And then they just concealed it all. So there was no blowout in the back of the head, but now there was a small entry wound at the top. Really completely outrageous. And I must reiterate, I was still dumbfounded. You know, when I realized the monstrosity of this deception, I called Cyril Wecht, who was a medical member of the medical panel, and I said, Cyril, I said, how did the HSC medical panel account for the gross discrepancy between the enormous missing back of the head, which was, you know, like virtually at least a third of the total cranial area, to this very small wound at the top of the head? And Cyril replied, I'll have to check my notes.
Oh, another one bites the dust. So, all right, gentlemen, to the topic at hand. All right, our scout went out into the field, Mr. Don Fox, and has come back with a field report that there's going to be an article coming up by none other than Jim DiEugenio, and the title is The Rise and Fall of Dr. James H. Fetzer. And he's going to explain to us just what happened and just where did Dr. Fetzer fall off the wagon. All right, so needless to say, we try to keep it clean around here, but that really hacked me and Don off. So we're calling first blood. All right, so Dr. Fetzer, they just threw a punch. I'm not sure if it got you in the face, but we're coming back. Don and I are about to whip some butt, and with Larry behind us, it's all over.
It was a whiffle. It was a complete air ball. They haven't. I mean, this is ridiculous. What is the fall? I can't wait to hear, Gary.
Well, we're not going to be waiting around. We're going to be taking a preemptive strike. All right. Now, Dr. Fetzer, what really brought us together in the beginning was debates. And we did our best because with all the turmoil in the JFK community, well, let's get some debates going. It seems to be the one thing that men can do that can get to the bottom of things. However, it was one of the most difficult things he's ever done is trying to get somebody to show up. All right, so we're going to be calling for a debate immediately with MD Eugenio, and each one of us tonight is going to be presenting evidence, and more or less, here's our questions, and here's what we want to know. And you don't have to contact us. Just respond on next week's show. If you got time to write an article on Dr. Fetzer, you've got time to debate us. All right, so just respond on the show. All right, so Larry and I are going to tag team on this one right here. All right, number one, the Z film.
Never. John wanted to squeeze a word in, Gary.
Can you guys hear me? It said my audio.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can. Okay, go ahead, Gary. Sorry about that.
All right. Now, we're going to be tag teaming Larry and I. We've got the motorcycle policemen themselves. So, Mr. DiEugenio, our first exhibit here is Officer Jackson, which we may be able to put up a picture of.
Un momento, Gary. This, I take it, is going to be over the Zapruder film. And,
The limo stop.
Yeah, well, while I was on, you know, still doing Black Op Radio with Len Osanek, we had the opportunity to interview Rich Della Rosa. And Rich had actually observed the film on three different occasions. So we have here, ready to play, what Rich reported to me and to Len. Mark that well. To Len Osanek, who is a participant in this interview and heard just what you're going to hear right now.
All right. All on the same show.
From Rich Della Rosa. Chance, let it roll.
Let's go.
Now, I took a stab at describing that film, and it is included in the book, The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, that Jim edited. It appears as Appendix E, and I guess it's really a good thing that we pounded a stake in the ground and said, okay, here are my recollections at this point, because now, several years later, we're relying on my little gray cells to remember the details of that film. So having it written down in 2003, turns out to be a good thing, because I'm finding as I go along, sometimes my memory is not the best tool that I have for doing research. But in that Appendix E to The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, we have a description of the film. And I'll kind of give it to you in a nutshell. If you have any questions after I'm done, please feel free to ask, and I'll answer them the best that I can. First of all, the film is a better quality film than the extant Zapruder film. Now, I was in the photography big time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I had my own dark room, and I knew all about film types and photographic terms and so forth. This other film was much better quality film. I would say that it was a professional quality film. It had great color rendition. Whereas if you look at the extant Zapruder film, you know, there are at least six versions of that floating around, provided to us at one point or another by Robert Grodin. Some are better quality than the others, but none of them are the quality of this other film. I mean, it had great color rendition and was a better film all around. The film started with the limousine on Houston Street as it approached the turn onto Elm Street. At that point, William Greer, the driver of the limo, had difficulty maneuvering that 110-degree turn onto Elm Street. And it appeared that at first he wasn't targeting the car to go down Elm Street, but rather that he was targeting the service road in front of the Texas School Book Depository. And then he began to struggle as he realized that that wasn't where he was supposed to go, and he maneuvered to try and get the limousine back toward the center lane of Elm Street. And you can see that in this film. I mean, the entire turn is included in the film, whereas in the Expanse Zapruder film, even though Zapruder said once he started filming, he didn't stop until the limo had gone by, the Expanse Zapruder film does not show the turn onto Elm Street. So the Greer maneuvers the heavy limousine in onto Elm Street, trying, as he was progressing down the street, to get it to the center lane. And just about the time that he got to the point where the gunshots occurred, there was a lot of activity on the right-hand side on the curb. The first thing he noticed was the guy that we call the Umbrella Man was furiously pumping the umbrella up and down. He wasn't just holding an open umbrella, as we've been fed by a number of other researchers. He was pumping the umbrella up and down. There was a lot of movement. The next thing was there was an individual that for many years we called the accomplice. And in later years, we called him the Cuban because he's a dark-complected man. He was wearing a cap. And in at least one still photograph, we can see that in his jacket, he had a radio device. I believe, although I know a couple of researchers don't agree, but I believe that that gentleman was Felipe Vidal Santiago. And he was furiously trying to get the attention of Greer. In fact, as the limo approached, that guy was in the street. He was standing in Elm Street. And there are a few still photographs where you can see that, in fact, he had stepped off the curb. And he was waving his arms. He finally signaled the driver with a closed fist, and this was clearly visible on this other film. And I'm told, I was in the Air Force, not the infantry, but I've been told that the closed fist signal is the infantryman's signal to stop. And it is quite apparent that when Greer saw the guy, he did exactly that. He stopped right there. He stopped on a dime. He stopped with such suddenness that it jostled the occupants of the limo. I mean, they were all thrown forward a bit as the limo came to a complete stop. Did not just slow down, it stopped. At that moment, Greer turned around with the limo stopped, and he faced JFK. And as he did, the choreography of this is astounding. He turned around, and he stared JFK in the face, and then you see JFK's head explodes from the frangible bullet. At that point, Greer turns back around, and he proceeds to get out of Dealey Plaza, although I gotta say, there was no evidence in the film that he floored it. He just saw that JFK had been hit, and he started the car. I don't know the specs on that car, how fast it can accelerate, but he did not, you know, do a rabbit start out of Dealey Plaza. And he went forward, and the lead car, quite simply, was in his way, so he swerved to the left, and he passed the lead car and proceeded to get to Stemmons Freeway to get the president to Parkland Hospital. Now, the events that I just described took place almost as if they were choreographed. And since I and a half dozen other people that I know have seen that film, when there's no question in our mind as to whether the limo slowed or it stopped. It stopped. Now, I don't mean that it parked. I mean it stopped for possibly 2 to 3 seconds. But during that interval, JFK was hit by two headshots. One where you could noticeably see his head move forward a bit. That would have been a shot to the rear of his head. I would suspect it was probably a low-velocity shot just based on the movement of his head. And then, of course, the gory exploding shot from the right front. And then Greer got the the limo out of Dealey Plaza. So it looked all very choreographed to me. But there's no question in our minds that the limo stopped. Now, there were a couple of frames in the Expanse of Bruder film. I don't remember which frame it was. I'm thinking it was 308, but I could be off, where Dr. Roderick Ryan, who worked for Kodak and was a consultant in the motion picture industry. In fact, when he retired, he got a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Oscars. He looked at the neighboring frames, and he was able to determine that the frames that showed the limo being blurred somewhat, the limo was in motion, and the one where the limo was in sharp focus, it was in sharp focus because the limo was standing still. So, I mean, we have even more evidence than just the other film that the limo had stopped. Now, I have to say that one would conclude from what you see between the limo reacting to somebody signaling it to stop and it stopping and so forth, that there was Secret Service complicity in the assassination. Of course, we know that agents were called off the limo, and they did not take their usual steps in protecting the car. But here we have both Greer and Kellerman aware somebody was approaching the car, and at that point, I think that I would have floored at that point, not knowing who that individual was, but instead, Greer stopped the car. And President Kennedy's head was blown off. So, you have any questions up to now?
No.
Well, Rich, that I think your experience was quite extraordinary in having the opportunity to see the film on those various occasions. And it makes me wonder, you know, who was responsible for providing those opportunities. It seems so unusual and so significant that it appears to me it had to have been done quite deliberately, though it's not obvious to me precisely to what effect, because so clearly it stuck with you and it's made a huge difference once you actually saw the Zapruder film, that you could tell so readily that it was a very, very different film. And I'm kind of struck that this even occurred on that campus.
Well, I had heard that a version of the film was floating around various college campuses, so when the opportunity presented itself to see the film, I guess I wasn't surprised. Now, where that film came from and how it got in the hands of whomever was projecting it at these different colleges, I have no idea. But you actually see a different set of events from the Zapruder film. And one thing I'd point out is that since we do have the extent Zapruder film available to us in various forms of media, that most of us, I mean, most researchers have seen it so many times that we don't need the film or a projector or a computer to view it. We can just recall it by memory. And I also think that that is somewhat deliberate. I used to refer to that as having that the Zapruder film dangled in front of us and made easily accessible. And the fact of the matter is that whomever they are, they wanted us to see that film. They wanted us to memorize that film, and they wanted us arguing for decades whether the limo stopped or the limo didn't stop, and so forth. Now, an interesting sidebar to this is that the expanse of the Zapruder film, having been altered by a variety of techniques, like inserting extra frames or frame stretching, techniques such as that, people that have only seen the expanse of Zapruder film typically have the reaction when they go to Dealey Plaza of saying, oh my God, Dealey Plaza is so much smaller than I imagined. And, you know, I assert that the reason for that is that if you watch the Zapruder film and you watch the infield grass where Mary Moorman and Gene Hill were standing, that the infield grass seems to go on longer than in reality because of all of the frame stretching that was employed in altering that film.
Dr. Fetzer, did I hear Rich Della Rosa say that everything that he saw in the film was in your book?
It's in the appendix. Rich Della Rosa has an appendix to the Great Zapruder film.
Yeah, Appendix E. Yeah, it's in Appendix E.
Right, so it's all been around for a very long time. And Lynn, I thought, was there and heard someone who had seen the film three times, and yet he's still in dispute, still lingering, still hesitating, still doubting over whether the video was altered, massively altered, the way we've described it. I mean, it's insulting. And I know Larry, by the way, has quite a few comments to make in addition, but Don, did you want to add something right now?
Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick, right at the end there, Rich was talking about how and I've heard this from other people too, that when everybody goes to Dealey Plaza, and I haven't been there yet, but everybody, boy, it looks so small compared to what, mm-hmm. you know, what I thought it was going to be. Well, yeah, because if you look at the Zapruder film, the people in the limo are a different size than the people in the background because it's a composite film. So it's kind of a mind trick. So when you get there, Dealey Plaza equals the Zapruder film. No, it doesn't. It's Dealey Plaza. Plaza, and then what you see in the Zapruder film is it's like if you go into that the fun house in the mirror, you know, it's all curvy.
You're right. As David Healy explained, it was done with optical printing and special effects whereby you can combine any foreground with any background. You can make actors do whatever you want them to do. JFK could have been doing somersaults and they could have put it right in the film. They mixed and matched. And as you're observing, the background is of a different perspective and proportion than the foreground, and it makes Dealey Plaza look much larger than it actually is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's focus on the limo stop now. It's mainly the limo stop, because if they can't get that right, then they can't get anything right. So, Larry, you ready to do some motorcycle cop stuff?
Yeah, well, first of all, I wanted to just start by commenting on what he said about Clear's turn. And which has been completely erased from the Zapruder film. And this was confirmed by Roy Truly. If you read Roy Truly's Warren Commission testimony, you'll see that he mentioned that Greer just barely missed the curb and running over people that were standing there right next to him. So That was the beginning of this massively edited Zapruder film where the first, 130 frames have been totally removed. Okay, now, he said that the limo stopped for 2 to 3 seconds, and but we now know that it was closer to 20 to 30 seconds, according to the Newcomb tapes. And it's interesting, I want to make a comment here on the Newcomb tapes, because recently I read in the JFKFacts.org, where they were asking what were the most important recent developments on the JFK case. And nobody mentioned the Newcomb tapes. And I think the Fred Newcomb tapes that we started presenting last year are perhaps the most important find in the JFK case, because...
Well, Larry, I believe that's the website where, when it came out, my website, Assassination Science, was listed among the worst.
Right.
JFK, and the reason given was because I believe the Zapruder film has been massively altered. Now, how dumb is that?
That's right. But as we all now know, these tapes that Fred Newcomb had stashed away and that his son Tyler made available to us, which had never been transcribed, and now with modern audio techniques that we were able to extract a lot of the information in these tapes. And the information there is unequivocal. You know, I mean, there's just no way to dispel and refute what the motorcycle cops, who were the immediate witnesses around the limousine, and what.
So the problem isn't with Assassination Science; it's with JFK Facts, which is a bit absurd, because facts have to be verifiable claims, and to deny that the Zapruder film is altered is to ignore verified findings that prove its alteration. So we have a lot of operators here throwing around a lot of, let us just say, non-truths.
Yeah,
well, I just happen to have the tapes with me right now.
Hold up. Yeah, I just wanted to segue into Gary, what Gary's going to present now, by just briefly mentioning that Hargis ran in front of Shaney on his way up to the knoll. And Shaney clearly states this in the interviews with the in the Newcomb tapes. And Hargis himself said that the limo stopped for 4 to 6 seconds. And he made a comment on this that you won't read about this in the Warren Commission, okay, because it's not in the extant film. And Jackson said the caravan stopped on two different occasions in two different phone interviews. He also saw 5 to 6 agents dismount from the Queen Mary and run past the limo with guns drawn. None of this is seen in the extant film. Okay, so Jackson himself stated that the film had been altered. It's been cut up. Okay, so Gary,
no, we don't
for us now.
Yeah, we don't. Right, let him tell us that.
Here we go. Okay. 2 seconds. I just wanted to.
He did, he said that car and they started accelerating about that time, and he missed it still. But I would argue that this didn't happen, but I didn't see it.
Did y'all hear that? It's been cut up. It's been edited. Let me play that a couple of more times.
That's Douglas Jackson.
There you go. One more time. A lot of it's been cut out. It's been edited. It's been cut up. They didn't show the limo stop. All right, so there's the first evidence for Mr. DiEugenio to refute. So go ahead, Larry, tell us some more.
Well, besides this, Davis Ellis, who was the supervisor of the motorcycle escort, spoke to James Shaney, and he spoke to Douglas Jackson and everybody, and he found out that a kid picked up a piece of skull that had fallen at his feet, and that a Secret Service agent snatched it away from the kid, he took the piece of skull and he threw it back into the limo before the convoy sped on under the triple overpass. So this is another instance of information that we have from immediate witnesses who were there, who apparently some people seem to keep wanting to ignore.
Right. How about B.J. Martin? Let's see what he had to say.
This film is a pretty film. It's an 8mm film that I'll send you.
All right.
Take a look at it. I'll give you a call so we can see it.
All right, I will do.
Because we see a lot of things in there. In fact, we see one thing which is very disturbing, that the car doesn't even stop in that film. It doesn't even slow down.
No, no, no.
Oh, somebody's monkeying around with something.
I would have sworn that it was a car that he tried to get up and the car stopped.
All right, now here we go. Just to make sure they didn't catch this part here.
I tried to get up and the car stopped. And the car stopped. And the car stopped.
That, the car stopped. Okay, so, all right, that was happened to be Billy, B.J. Martin. Anybody want to comment? Larry, Don?
Well, you've got better tapes on that. Douglas Jackson said twice that the limo stopped. He even talked about five or six agents running past the limo with guns drawn. And none of this is seen in the Zapruder film. So you've got a lot more material there, Gary.
All right. Well, how about Bobby Hargis?
Do you remember how long it stopped when it was on Elm Street?
Oh, you mean after that first shot?
Right.
Only about 3-4 seconds, maybe perhaps.
I say it stopped for about 5 or 6 seconds.
Yeah, but you won't find that.
Don't they claim that it stopped?
No. I don't think it didn't. You've seen a rolling stop, haven't you? It's going less than 1 mile an hour.
Right, right.
Well, that's what he was doing. He wasn't completely stopped, the dead still.
So how many seconds?
Oh, 3-4 seconds, maybe fast.
I'd say it's stopped for about 5 or 6 seconds.
Yeah, but you won't find that.
That's Bobby Hargis talking from the grave to you and I. So there's my exhibit. All right, so we're going to have James Chaney next. So you want to comment on that one, fellas?
Well, yeah, the limo definitely stopped, and we don't see that. And then it also, you know, Rich was talking about after the limo finally got going again, he had to pass another car. You don't see any of that in the Zapruder.
Right.
You don't see any of it.
That's right.
All right. We'll do Douglas Jackson. Here we go. Doug, you know what? We really are having a hard time commenting because these guys are saying it all right here.
That's right.
I liked it. The only thing is I thought that caravan stopped and it didn't.
Wait, I just got to play that again. I thought that caravan stopped, but it didn't.
I liked it. The only thing is, I thought that caravan stopped and it didn't.
Right, that's, you know, I was just speaking with Jim and with Bobby before Hargis and Chaney.
Yeah.
We sort of went over a couple of points, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the points we did discuss with them.
So all of the police officers are all saying the same thing, that, you know, we're happy you sent us the Z film, but there was this big stop, and it just doesn't happen to be in there. And it's just devastating to anyone who can stand in this day and time and say, you know, Robert Groden says, you know, it's authentic, so we might as well have to go with it. These are the police officers drenched in blood and brain matter. All right, so we got James Chaney, and then I've got one more montage after that. Well, this is a little difficult. I'm going to see what I can do about that one. Tell us what we're hearing there, Larry, because I know it's inaudible.
Well, it's pretty audible when you break it down with special software that enhances audio, which is definitely available to anybody who wants to break it down. But yeah, he's clearly saying that the limo stopped and that Bobby Hargis ran in front of him on his way up to the grassy knoll. Now, in order for that to have happened, you're talking about both limos stopping completely. for him to have dismounted his motorcycle and ran in between the two limos. When he says in between the two limos, he's talking about the JFK limo, which was the Lincoln Continental, and the Queen Mary, which was the Cadillac. Dr. Fetzer, do you have anything to say about this?
Well, Larry, you're making excellent points, but of course, people like Jefferson Morley, Robert Groden, Josiah Thompson, Jim DiEugenio, Len Ossanek, their minds are made up. They don't want to be bothered with facts.
You mean by the motorcycle cops who were there? They just don't have time to listen to these guys. I mean, who the heck are they?
They don't have time for serious research. Anyone who has followed the development of research on the Zapruder film, from Assassination Science to Murder in Dealey Plaza to the great Zapruder film hoax, understands the multitudinous of ways in which the film has been altered and changed, including, of course, in frames 374 and others. You can actually see the blowout, which has been concealed in earlier frames. But the duration and complexity of the limo stop is the coup de grace that puts an end to it all. And it's embarrassing that you'd have a website like JFK Facts that can't deal with the evidence. They aren't interested in facts. They're interested in smoke and mirrors, which is what they're pushing at JFK Facts. Grossly misnamed, tragic, abusive language.
And you know, I've posted a couple of times on the JFK Facts the actual transcripts of from some of these motorcycle cops. And many people who have commented really accepted the information, but apparently they're not inclined to continue to propagate this information. Just, you know, apparently they don't really care about this.
Larry, how come you haven't been a guest on Black Ops Radio? I mean, a man who's uncovered tapes that were closest there would be the most welcome guy in the JFK community. What's the problem?
Well, apparently they don't want to hear about information that is being brought out by the actual people, witnesses who were there.
Who are these James Chaney and Bobby Hargis guys?
Yeah, right.
I'm going to call.
What would they know about a limo stop?
Right. Yeah. Right. And not only that, Jim, don't forget that they were never interviewed by any of the official investigative bodies, A, and B, up until 1975, when the FBI belatedly interviewed them, that is when they finally documented what they had gone through. And some of the information that we found there, you know, was just totally ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, the FBI knew what it was doing by not interviewing the most important witnesses. They were covering it up. Lyndon was the principal facilitator of the assassination, J. Edgar of the cover-up.
That's right.
All right, Dr. Fetzer, we were in Dealey Plaza last year, and we actually have an exclusive interview here with Beverly Oliver and see what she has to say about the motorcycle cops. Whoops.
It passed by. The shots had happened. The limousine had taken off or was about to take off, and the policeman on this side parked his bike. Ran up the hill, and his bike fell over. Now, I don't remember seeing one going up the hill on the motorcycle, but I remember the one line.
His bike fell over. He stopped and ran between the limousine and up the hill. I didn't see that in the Z film there, Dr. Fetzer.
Well, gee, Gary, it must have blinked. Surely it must be there.
Yeah, but Bob Gordon. Bob Groden said it's legit, and wasn't he interviewed on by Geraldo Rivera? So doesn't Bob know what he's talking about?
Oh, yeah, man.
It was Groden who got the film on to Geraldo that led to the investigation by the HSCA. But it's all so embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the frauds, they just stick out like, you know, sore thumbs, like they're smashing their thumb with a hammer again and again. Groden, Thompson,
I'm sorry.
Jefferson Morley. Jim DiEugenio, Len Ossanek, what are these people, nitwits?
Well, there's more witnesses. Let's don't talk to them. Let's talk to the witnesses. Hold on. We got more witnesses here to talk with.
Go for it, Gary.
Okay.
And I've always had a memory. Matter of fact, I've had nightmares about it, of the sunlight on Kennedy and the explosion. The car almost coming to a stop. almost to a dead stop.
But what I couldn't really believe that someone else mentioned was the car, and after that first shot, it come practically to a stop. And later on, and looking back, when I said I could not believe how well-trained Secret Service people reacted so slowly. I would expect that from ordinary human beings, but I expected that they would react much quicker.
Those in the cars behind saw the presidential car.
It was just an instantaneous, sort of an instant pause in the motorcade momentary car.
The car that the president was driving, that was that had been set up from the White House suite in Washington. This car came to an immediate stop.
This is going to be screened out for no. The car stopped momentarily.
As we go in the corner to go by a small park right on the edge of town, we heard three shots. We heard the explosions. We didn't know what they were. And suddenly the motorcade slowed a little. There was a brief pause. Then the cars rushed the wounded man to Stockwell Hospital.
All right. Well, how about nine witnesses right there in the montage?
Well, Gary, we already had a report from Vince Palomaro about witnesses to the limo stop and murder in Dealey Plaza. The number was about 60. And yeah. John Costello published a brilliant piece, a compilation of the witness evidence in what happened on Elm Street. The eyewitnesses speak in assassinationresearch.com. which he and I co-edit as a journal for advanced study of the death of JFK. Anyone can check it online. But were these like Jim DiEugenio, Robert Groden, Aleno Sanic, Tink Thompson, Jefferson Morley? I guess they just don't have time to bother with evidence.
Well, what about Malcolm Summers? Who the heck was he? Wait, wasn't he the guy that jumped on the Zapruder film on the ground? Let's see what he had to say about it.
I thought someone had threw a firecracker down on the ground just to be smart. But then the procession kept coming. And then the second and the third shot rang out. Well, I knew it was being shot at. I knew that was what was happening. The car got right beside me where I was at. And it actually stopped momentarily. And I heard Jackie Kennedy say, "Oh, God, no, no." And heard John Collins say, "They're going to shoot us all."
Summers then ran into the Secret Service agent, who never was.
He was a gentleman in a suit and a hat and tie, and he had a gun over his raincoat, and I could only see the barrel of it. He said, "Y'all better not come up here." And he wasn't only talking to me, it was other people running there. You can get shot.
All right.
And it actually stopped.
What did he
and
say?
It actually stopped.
Wait, what did he say?
And it actually stopped.
All right.
It actually stopped.
Somebody talk to us, Don. Go ahead.
Okay, I just want, before everything wraps up here, a few key areas where we know the Zapruder film has been massively altered. Okay, the turn from Houston onto Elm, it's just not even there in the exit.
That's right.
It's not even there. And every report I've ever heard, it echoes Rich Della Rosa, where Greer almost misses Elm Street completely, and he almost went down that. There's that little, it's
called, road.
Yeah, the Elm Street Annex that goes right in front of the Texas School Book building.
So yeah, the road.
Yeah, his tires ended up on the sidewalk. You see none of that. And then, of course, we've talked about the people in the background are larger than the people in the foreground. And then another key area to look at is with all the missing frames, Greer kept turning around to see what was going on in the back of the limo. But with all the missing frames, his head is whipping around at twice or more than the speed that he should be able to turn around. And then I think the last key, the last couple of key spots are, of course, the limo stop, which we've documented, ad infinitum here. Mm-hmm. And then we don't see Greer passing any sort of a lead car either, which Rich Della Rosa reported.
And of course, they had to merge the two shots. So you had he actually slumps forward after being hit in the back of the head. Jackie eases him back up. She's looking him right in the face when he's hit in the right temple by the frangible or exploding bullet. His brains are blown out to the left rear with such force that when they impact with Officer Hargis, he himself thinks he's been shot. And then Jack slumps to the left. But when they merged those two shots, they took out too many frames and created this jerky, violent motion to left and rear, which no one in Dealey Plaza reported.
All right. Question, fellas. Have any of you guys heard of her name is Jean Hill?
That name seems familiar.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what she had to say.
This is Jean Hill of Dallas. Could you tell us what you saw?
Yes, Mary and I had come down to see the president this morning, and we tried to get a place where we could be away from everyone, and we, I guess, succeeded. As the car came down the hill toward us, he was on our side of the street, and the president and Mrs. Kennedy were in the back seat, had a little dog between them looking at it, and just as the car came right in line with us, the president looked up, and just as he looked up, two shots rang out, and he grabbed his chest, and this real odd look came over his face, and he pitched forward onto her lap. And she jumped up over him at that and screamed and said, "My God, he's been shot." And there was just an instantaneous, sort of an instant pause, and the motorcade momentarily halted.
Wait, did it what?
Momentarily halted. Momentarily halted. And three or four more shots rang out, and they sped away real quickly. And that time I became aware of Mary tugging on my foot, saying, "Get down there." She hadn't registered. I'd been so busy looking at the president.
You were in a very advantageous spot to see the president.
To see the president, but also to get shot.
How do you feel now? It's been several hours later, and you've talked to the police, given your story several times. Do you still believe that something like this really did happen here?
I don't think I ever could have believed it unless I had actually seen it. And when I saw the look come across his face, I knew that he'd been hit.
All right, there's just another, you know, two-bit witness right there saying the limo stopped. We got one more clip, so let's might as well play that one, and then we'll be done with the clips, and we can comment it on the way out. Here we go.
Had there been better reaction on the part of the driver? They were only yards from what at least I perceived to be safety by getting on the expressway. But the car seemed to just, it didn't move. After that first shot, it just didn't move. And the thing that has, over the years, continued to rather haunt me about the whole situation was the feeling that did that first shot miss, as I felt it had? If it did miss, had that car speeded up, would he be alive today?
All right, so there's Mary Woodward.
Yeah.
She wouldn't know anything either, would you think?
Yeah, she was there, and she makes so many key points. Well, if the limo driver would have just floored it. So, I mean, and I think anybody with a brain would agree with Mary there that if the limo driver doesn't come to a complete halt, Kennedy probably doesn't get shot in the head two or three times. I mean, how did Oswald edit this film when he was in custody in the Dallas police station on Friday night? Wasn't this thing edited on Friday night? Saturday.
Yeah, Larry and Dr. Fetcher has done work on the Hawkeye lab and how much time and where it's all gone.
Oh, yeah, John, you weren't here when I gave a recap about what the technical errors that Robert Morningstar had wrong. Where the original was taken to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Saturday, it was an 8mm all-ray split film developed in Dallas. How the substitute was brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center on Sunday, it was a 16mm unsplit film, and that's where the switch was made. They had a briefing board prepared on Saturday, but a second on Sunday. And another misstatement by Robert was that those weren't missing frames between what they were featuring on the briefing boards. So those were the number of frames between the shots. So they could calculate the amount of time that it had taken to separate them to support the three-shot scenario.
Well, I also want to add to that which we discussed last week about the blowout in the back of the head. We know that that blob that has been painted over in frames 3, 13, 3, 14, et cetera, vis-a-vis the blowout in the back of the head, which you discovered in the frame 374, and which later we also discovered earlier this year in 343, where Jackie's glove provided such a nice background and where we saw the magnitude of the blowout in the back of the head. So that in itself tells us a lot about what transpired, you know, when this film was edited that weekend.
You're absolutely right, Larry. Those are very nice observations. I'd just like to make two remarks. One is that I think that Jefferson Morley ought to redesignate his site JFK Fiction because it has very little to do with fact. And also that since Jim DiEugenio replaced me on Black Op Radio, the meaning of Black Op in relation to radio has assumed a whole different dimension.
Don, and Larry, weren't these people larger than life at one time? I was actually nervous to even contact someone like Jim Fetzer, and I actually will admit that I meekly walked up to Jim DiEugenio in Dealey Plaza one time to ask him a question because he was the man. And just so many times people that we've looked up to have let us down. And that's what we're taking the time to show you just how bad it is. We're just talking the limo stop. So if 50 witnesses is not enough for you, then we have serious problems here. And you're going to take time to write an article about the rise and fall of Dr. Fetzer? We've got a problem.
My thought, I mean, if you can't get the Zapruder film right in JFK research, what are you doing in JFK research?
Well, what's most blatant, Don, is I published an over 500-page volume proving that the film was a fabrication in 2003. What year is it now?
It's not like it snuck up on anybody. Yeah, it's 2015.
I mean, there are only two choices. Either they're completely and utterly incompetent and have refused to familiarize themselves with the relevant evidence, or they are perpetrating a complete fraud on the public and other members of the JFK community to promote a political agenda. I don't think the choice between those alternatives is too tough to make, given what we know about what's going on here.
Yeah,
it's possible that another one of the topics that might be brought up in that article might be your position on the Auction 6, Jim. So you want to just make a couple of comments?
That's very interesting, where, you know, we have proof after proof of the alteration of the Auction 6. But what's so fascinating there is that he actually captured a man in the doorway who bears a striking resemblance to Lee Oswald. He has a similar height. He has a similar build. He has a similar appearance. He has similar clothing. He has a similar shirt. He has a similar T-shirt. And they want to say, no, that was actually a guy who was 3 inches shorter and 15 or 20 pounds heavier, is actually standing to his right as you look at the Alchins, who actually went to the FBI on 29 February 1964 to show them the shirt he had been wearing at the time, which they had asked him to bring in and duly photographed. A short sleeve, vertically striped red and white shirt, which bears no resemblance. So neither with respect to height or weight or build or clothing does Billy Lovelady resemble Lee Harvey Oswald. And yet when he was arrested, he was wearing a shirt strikingly similar to the shirt on the man in the doorway, a T-shirt similar to the man on the doorway. He was of a height similar to the man on the doorway. He was of a build similar to the man in the doorway. I mean, how ridiculous does this have to get? And then they proposed as an alternative this guy in the crowd wearing a red and black checkered shirt, which is buttoned up to the neck, whereas the shirt on the man in the doorway is splayed open all the way down to his navel. And they want to propose this guy who looks like a gorilla, and must outweigh the doorman by 50 pounds, is supposed to be the man in the doorway? I can't believe the rubbish we get from people like Robert Brodin and Tink Thompson and Jim DiEugenio and now Leto Sanik and Jefferson Morley. It's really pathetic. When I organized the Vancouver hearings in 2012, I visited Leto Sanik at his studio outside of Vancouver. and I did three interviews with Lynn for his 50 points about, you know, of truth about the JFK for his series. I did one about the role of the Secret Service, explaining we have 15 indications of Secret Service complicity. And when I came right up to the point of talking about the limousine hold and some additional remarks, he cut it. He cut out those points. I did two others. I did one just on the limousine and the Zapruder film itself, going over point after point after point. He chose not to use it. I did another about the Alton 6 and the man in the doorway. He chose not to use it. I am stunned that Len Osanek, with whom I co-hosted that show for many years, has turned out to be so utterly irresponsible and now it would seem mentally despondent by agreeing with Jim DiEugenio on whatever Jim DiEugenio wants to throw out.
All right, well, they're not going to be escaping their audience as well. We did have a comment, and the comment was, and we'll close out the show, WTF, what the heck has gone wrong with Black Ops Radio? What tripe are they trying to shovel here? Using Dr. Fetzer's name as a verb? He says, they have had many, many guests who are purporting exactly what Dr. Fetzer is saying. So what is wrong here? So basically that comment brought the whole show here tonight.
Well, there's truth in advertising to this extent, Gary. They do advertise themselves as a black op.
Yes. One last point I would make is if Black Op Radio is using Fetzer's name as a verb, so does Judy Wood. So, you know, perhaps they're in the same ilk now as the Judy Woods of the world.
All right. Black Op Radio, the show the NSA wants you to hear. We'll see you next week. This has been JFK 74. Thanks, fellas.